Well, good evening. In any case, when I'm going to give a talk, oftentimes the day of the talk, I try to set aside some time to sit zazen, to sit in meditation. And so I did manage to set aside some time to do that today. And as I was sitting, a phrase came to my mind. And the phrase was, why have the enlightened ones appeared in the world? And I don't know where that phrase came from. Probably from some text I read at some point. Maybe it comes from one of the koans. I don't know. Why have the enlightened ones appeared in the world? And if I was asked to answer that question, I would say, well, the enlightened ones have appeared to share their enlightenment with us, to freely share it with us. And they've also appeared to relieve suffering. And maybe a third reason that's connected to both of these is they appear in the world to broadly benefit living beings. And so because they've made a vow to actually do these things, to share their enlightenment and relieve suffering and broadly benefit living beings, they have over the centuries offered many teachings that will help us move in their direction, move toward them, join them in the project of waking up. So one of the things we like to do in this study, this Sangha group, is we like to study these teachings that have been handed down. And we do that in various ways, these talks, and we have an ongoing study group on Thursday mornings. And in that group recently, the teaching that we've been studying is the teaching that's been handed down by the enlightened ones in our Soto Zen tradition. And this is the teaching called 16 Bodhisattva precepts. So bodhisattvas are the enlightened ones, or the enlightening ones, or the ones on the path of enlightenment. And so this is the teachings that they offer to the rest of us, all of us on the path, that they want to join them, the 16 bodhisattva precepts. And so we've been studying, kind of detailed, making a deep dive into the origins, the evolution of these precepts. How did they come to be? And who were the enlightened ones who refined them, defined them, and offered them to us? I'm not going to go in tonight to all 16 because that's too big of a project. But I thought tonight I would concentrate on three of them, which are called the three pure precepts. So briefly, there are three refuges in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There are three pure precepts or general precepts, and then there are 10 precepts that define specific behaviors that we should avoid in order to join the enlightened ones on the path. So I'm going to talk about these three general precepts, three pure precepts. And these three, I said in the study group, I said, if you encountered a person who didn't know anything about Buddhism, and that person asked you, what do Buddhists believe in anyway? Well, you could answer that we believe, we Buddhists, if you, or we could say those Buddhists, depending on your orientation to the tradition, they believe in three pure precepts. They believe in conducting themselves ethically. They believe in practicing wholesome dharmas. And they believe that liberation is accessible to everyone and is dependent on our own conduct. So these three pure precepts have roots in oldest Buddhist tradition, the tradition of the earliest Pali text that has been translated, called the Dhammapada. And in that text, there was a teaching known as the teaching of all Buddhas. And the teaching of all Buddhas was very simple. It was like these three pure precepts. It was in three, and the three were: avoid all evil, do all good, purify the mind. Avoid all evil, do all good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. So those three came down through the tradition, and they were recognized by the tradition, by the Buddhists who grew up in China, and taken into the tradition in China, called the Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle tradition of Buddhism in China. And those three were massaged by that tradition, and they came out as follows. The first pure precept is embrace and sustain ethical conduct. The second pure precept is embrace and sustain all good dharmas, all wholesome dharmas. And the third pure precept is embrace and sustain all sentient beings, broadly benefit all sentient beings. So I'll say a little bit about each of the pure precepts, but then I'm mostly going to focus on the third pure precept, or that's where I want to go with this. But the first pure precept is a precept, it's a commitment to restraint. It's making a commitment to restrain, you know, it says in the old tradition, avoid all evil. So in our understanding, it's restrain ignoble impulses and behavior based on them. It's the don't do. So it's a commitment to live ethically and do no harm. Do no harm to self or others. So it's broadly stated as, I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. Another formulation is, I vow to refrain from all action that is rooted in ignorance. The other formulation is, I vow to refrain from all action that creates attachment. The latter one, I think, was from Katagiri Roshi. So we have various formulations that we read in our study. But anyway, you can see that the first pure precept is about refraining. It's about it's acknowledging that we have, you know, we have greed, hate, and delusion, and we should be careful around it. And there are things that we sh- there may be impulses that arise in us that are based in attachment and ignorance, and it's the precept of restraining those impulses and not acting on them, calming them, massaging them, caring for them in a way, you know, caring for them enough so that we don't act on them. So the second pure precept is a commitment to practice all good dharmas, all wholesome dharmas. It's a commitment. This is more of a positive precept. It's the things to do good for self and others. Do all good for self and others. Practice all wholesome dharmas. Practice faith, practice love, practice loving kindness. Practice the wholesome dharmas for self and others. It's simply stated, the vow to embrace and sustain all good. Other formulations are the precept of sustaining wholesome dharmas. The precept, another formulation is the precept to do only good. To do only good. So then we come to the third precept, pure precept, and that's kind of really where I wanted to focus in this talk and also on Saturday. How do we enact this precept to broadly benefit all living beings? How do we practice for the welfare of all living beings? And the third precept, pure precept in the older tradition, is purify the mind. So how is that taken into the Mahayana and come out as broadly benefit all living beings? So we have these in our study, we have these various ways that different teachers have translated and offered these precepts. And there was a really, nice, thoughtful merging of the older understanding and then the Mahayana understanding that came from Suzuki Roshi. And he said his translation of the third pure precept is, with purity of heart, I pledge to strive for the benefit of living beings and the whole society. This is a very, wonderful, merging, I think, of these two ideas that the way, one of the ways that we benefit other beings is by, being pure of heart, by being careful about our own conduct, we help other people be careful about their conduct. We help other people follow the path of liberation. With purity of heart, I pledge to strive for the benefit of living beings and the whole society. In the Jukai ceremony, or the ceremony of taking the precepts, it says, I vow to live for the benefit of all beings. Simply that. And Dogen says, I vow to live and be lived. I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. Zazen, practice is about being lived. It's a practice of being lived, being sustained by everything for the benefit of all beings, lived by. We live and we are lived by. And this is what we come more and more to appreciate in our sitting practice. We may not see, you know, how our practice always benefits other people. We don't really go around looking to see, you know, did what I do just then benefit someone? We're not like trying to accumulate, you know, merit or evidence of benefit. We try to practice with faith that our example, our conduct, our way of being, you know, helps other people. It sets an example. People appreciate the way that we walk in this world. We could hope that, you know, might happen, but we're not looking for that, you know, and we're not trying to create some kind of a ledger so that that's what happens. So one of the ancient commentators that we read in our study is a fellow named Asanga, and he was one of the creators, the co-creators, the co-founders, the co-fathers of the Yogacara school of Buddhism. In his discussion of the third pure precept, he offered 11 ways that bodhisattvas can, quote, be established in the ethics of accomplishing the welfare of sentient beings. 11 ways. And I'm not going to talk about all 11 ways, but there were three that kind of jumped out at me and I thought would be worth talking about. So, and this is how Asanga characterizes three of these modes of benefiting sentient beings, accomplishing the welfare of sentient beings. He says, this is his prescription for bodhisattvas, enlightening beings. He says, the bodhisattva dispels the suffering that comes along with certain kinds of involvement in ill will. The bodhisattva dispels the suffering of those who suffer from involvement with objects of desire. That's his first one. The second one is the bodhisattva dispels the suffering of those who suffer involvement in ill will, lack of energy, drowsiness, excitedness, regret, and preoccupation with objects of desire. And then he says, and as with preoccupation with objects of desire, so should one understand preoccupations with ill will, injury, kinfolk, fellow countrymen, deities, as well as preoccupation connected with reputation and family prosperity. So my thought about this is that as people living in the world, we've kind of chosen the path of involvement, and it's hard to avoid involvement with objects of desire, and involvement in general. It's hard to avoid that as people living in the world. But the text says that our job as bodhisattvas is to dispel the suffering that comes along with certain kinds of involvement, especially involvements that become preoccupations. So I thought about my own life in this regard, and there was a situation that happened to me some years ago, where I, you know, he says one of the things to avoid is preoccupation with injury. And in this case, for me, I managed to injure myself by ill-advisedly jumping out of the bed of a pickup truck. And I injured myself doing so. And that injury resulted in, well, about a period of a whole year where I couldn't walk without a limp and without pain. And I became very obsessed with that injury and the fear of not recovering from it, so much so that I became depressed. So in addition to physical therapy, I had to, you know, get counseling to deal with my preoccupation with this injury and my whole self's kind of collapsing in upon around the effect of this injury. So that's the kind of preoccupation that, you know, we can fall prey to. Preoccupation with injury. Kinfolk. Anybody preoccupied with their kinfolk? I know there's some here in this Sangha that have quite a bit of preoccupation with their kinfolk and, you know, involvement and so forth. Involvement's one thing, preoccupation may be another thing. And I know that I've talked to a number of people in this Sangha and elsewhere about preoccupation with fellow countrymen. There's been a lot of concern in the last year or so about what are our fellow countrymen up to and what are they thinking and what are their values and what are they going to do? And there's been a lot of preoccupation with that and a lot of suffering associated with that preoccupation. So, I don't know if you resonate with this idea of preoccupation or not, becoming obsessed with certain, you know, things that are happening in your life, whether they be injury, kinfolk, fellow countrymen. Probably people aren't too worried about preoccupation with deities, I don't suppose, here. That's okay. We're free of that. Maybe that's good. But the best thing, you know, the best way to practice with preoccupation is to, first of all, you know, recognize that we do have these preoccupations, that maybe we're spending a little too much time, a little too much psychic energy, obsessing about certain things. Certain factors, certain people or in our life or things that are happening to us. And maybe the way that we're preoccupying ourselves isn't so helpful. Maybe it verges into, instead of just involvement, like if you have an injury, well, of course, you should be involved with it. You should go to the doctor and you should get therapy and so forth. But then the injury becomes, you know, bigger and bigger and takes up a bigger portion of your life than you want it to, then it verges into a kind of suffering. So we have to, you know, I think it's helpful to be aware that we can verge into preoccupation. And we should question preoccupation. Is this a source of suffering? Is the way I'm thinking about it, is the amount of time I'm spending on this helpful to me? Or is it actually, you know, causing me more pain than the thing that I'm preoccupied about. So I would say that cutting through, dispelling, so Sangha says that bodhisattvas work to dispel, you know, their activity. One of bodhisattva activity is to dispel preoccupation. And I would say that this is the bread and butter of Zen student practice, dispelling preoccupation. Recognizing that we may have preoccupations, and in our sitting practice, we face preoccupations, and sitting with them, we dispel them. Recognizing them, that they come up, we dispel them. So that is like the everyday work of bodhisattvas. Everyday work. Sometimes, wonderfully, we may be able to sit. We may be able, and this, the best time for this is formal practice, sitting upright in samadhi. We may be able to entirely let go of our preoccupations. We have this wonderful practice of not putting anything before the mind. Put nothing before the mind except the mind. Put the mind before the mind. And when you can put, in your sitting upright practice, you put your mind before the mind and nothing comes before the mind. This is the great relief. This is the great relaxation. This is the great letting go. Nothing comes before the mind. It's kind of a double entendre there. I'll let you work with that. The other teachings that, you know, the enlightened ones offer to us is that the natural state of mind, or the Buddha nature, if you will, the Buddha nature is non-dispelled. Excuse me, the Buddha nature is dispelled. Buddha nature is dispelled. There is just dispelling. There is just the dispelled nature of the mind without anything arising, without anything coming in the way, coming in front of the mind. There are no objects of mind. This is Buddha nature, completely dispelled. And this is what I talked at the beginning, that the enlightened ones, why do they appear in the world? They appear in the world to talk to us about this, and convince us and encourage us in this dispelled nature, this nature that is completely free of all preoccupations. And encourage us to practice in that way and with that nature. Put that mindfulness to the fore, the mindfulness of dispelling to the fore. Dogen in his instructions for Zazen says, cease all involvement and suspend all affairs. Do not think good and do not think of bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all involvements. Suspend all affairs. This is a great relaxation. Great practice of great space. Practice of freedom. Spending some time in this way. Or never fail to receive profound help from all Buddhas and ancestors. Well, I'm so glad this is my last Zoom talk. I just agreed to give another one to another group, and I'm really wondering why I did that. Because it's so hard, even though I see your faces, it's so hard to connect and feel your energy. You know, once in a while I see a smile or some hint of recognition, but you know, some of you are rather fuzzy, you know, in your aspect and not very focused. Some of you are rather dark, you know. Some of you are, I don't even know, too. I've never met in person. So we're going to try to go back to this, you know, face-to-face, body-to-body practice. It's so important in our tradition. It's so vital. And none of the enlightened ones ever imagined, you know, teaching, trying to communicate to a screen with people moving on it and, you know, doing various things or sitting still. So it's a hard situation, you know. But maybe we can pray that it's over, or it could be over for us. We know it's not over for everyone, and that's we certainly need to be mindful of that. And if there's anything that we can do to, you know, promote the science or promote herd immunity, then we should do that. We shouldn't try to just, you know, be in some privileged enclave where we are, you know, get to do things and other people don't. But nevertheless, you know, we have to have our life. A life of practice is so vital. So if you'd like to, you know, raise any questions, confess your preoccupations, and whatever you would like to offer, please feel free to raise your hand and I will call on you.
I think Will has his hand up.
Oh, Will, yes.
Thank you, Jim. Anytime I hear you speak, you always answer the question before I get a chance to ask them. So I always wait it out. But it was interesting that you mentioned about jumping out of the the truck and hurting your leg, because I meet people along the trail and they're regulars. They become good friends and we have long chats. It's like, and one of the people that I meet with, cross paths with, I hadn't seen in over a year. And they were telling me that they had some arthritis in the ankle. It's a young person, and that they're not going to be able to walk, or they have to walk with a limp. And I had to pause because I'm saying, I did have to refrain because I wanted to offer this remedy, that, this suggestion and that. And I did refrain, and I felt good for not giving advice. But the question came up is, how do you distinguish between dispelling preoccupation with indifference to other people's suffering?
Oh, well, yeah, you could just thoughtfully, I think you're already doing it in a way, you know, you meet these people on the path and you talk to them and they share with you what is going on for them and what their concerns are, and you're listening with an open mind and a mind that doesn't think it the answers to life's persistent questions is a gift, actually. Just meeting them that way is a gift in itself. The teaching says, the Bodhisattva wants to dispel people's preoccupations, but it doesn't exactly say how to do that. So in moment-to-moment activity, we have to, we think, what is the best way here? And it sounds to me like, you just listen to that person, and maybe that was, that was a gift right then, just having someone listen to what had happened to them and what was going on for them. Maybe that was enough. Dave, do you have a question?
So where does, say, purposeful involvement end and preoccupation begin? I know so many of us near to overwhelmed, say, with social justice issues, just involvement in greater things. But where does it, so where's the dividing line between involvement and preoccupation? I wonder, or is that just up to each of us to figure out on our own?
Well, here's an example. I don't know if it's totally, but it's the one that came to mind, so I'll just offer it. I've been doing this practice called intermittent fasting. And it's where you basically, you don't eat as many, you only eat two meals a day versus three meals a day. You eat a late breakfast, essentially, and at least that's the way most people, I think, do it. And then you don't eat again, or you don't eat much again until dinner. When the book about intermittent fasting, it says, don't weigh yourself every day. So part of the point is to lose weight or control your weight, right? And but preoccupation is like getting on the scale every day and seeing how am I doing, you know? So, you start with some good intent, like, oh, I'm going to try this diet out, the different way of eating and see how it works. And then you could become like obsessed by it and And I have to, I found I actually have to restrain myself. Don't, you know, don't get on the scale, you know, that's not really the point, you know, to get on the scale every day and see how I'm doing, you know? So, and that's what the book said, don't get on the scale every day. So, I mean, this is a silly example in a way, but it's that, you know, you can be involved in everything. You should, you know, you should be involved in everything that you want to be involved in, but then if it becomes like, you can tell when like greed takes over or gaining mind, when gaining mind takes over, you know? And so, you know, look for that, I would say. Look for, you know, some, you're trying to hold a measuring stick up to how well you're doing. Well, then that's preoccupation. That's what I would say.
Thank you.
Josh and Laura.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for your talk, Jim. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank you. As I've shared with you, I have my own preoccupation right now. We both do. But it's been affecting my practice. It's been something I've been struggling with. And I just wanted to say thank you because this talk really resonated. And it at times felt like you were speaking directly to me. So that's how I knew I needed this. So just thank you.
You're welcome. I would say you have an involvement, yes. I'm not, you know, it may be quite constant. I understand that. For people that don't know, Josh and Laura have a new baby. So, you know, I understand that is somewhat, I would say that's not a preoccupation, but it's an involvement that's rather all consuming. So, but there's a difference there, you know, and your involvement is not more than is needed. I don't think in that case it can ever be so. Thank you for taking care of the involvement that you have joyfully engaged in and are engaging in.
Thank you.
Clement Spring.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for your talk this evening. When you were talking about preoccupation, what it brought to mind to me was preoccupation as being a source of suffering. And I don't know if I've said this in one of these meetings or not, but I discussed it with you the last time we were in person together. And I found it to be quite helpful. And I encountered this in one of the Nikayas that I read recently. And if you think of preoccupation as a source of suffering, what the Nikaya said was that suffering is to be understood, that the origin of suffering is to be abandoned, the cessation of suffering is to be realized, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering is to be developed. And I've been working with this lately, and I found it to be quite helpful. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. I think I've seen that phrase. Maybe you put it in your email there. I it sounds familiar.
Yes, I put it in the Go On duty assignment a few months ago.
Thank you for doing that. Helpful reminder. Tora Lee?
Oh, thank you. I just was reflecting for myself about preoccupation, and I'm thinking of one relationship in particular that was very precious to me and very close, and something changed in the relationship where the other person got more distant. And that is what sort of stirred this kind of preoccupation in a mental process. And, you know, in a way, it's a form of clinging, the preoccupation. Like I was sort of clinging to wishing it were the way it was before. And it wasn't until I could sort of drop down and feel the grief and also feel the goodness of what was that the preoccupation, you know, left. It was like, you know, it was a kind of clinging, trying to hold on to something that it was not that way anymore. And so it kind of also restored a way that I could love myself too in that process. So thank you.
Well, it's kind of sounds like kind of a, you know, a grief situation, and grief, you know, is a thing that, you know, that kind of grieving for the way it was. And sometimes I think, don't you think it's kind of necessary to go through that phase, you know? So maybe, you know, we should be soft about this preoccupation thing, you know, that there may be a necessary, you know, preoccupation, like a grief of loss. That's a natural human, you know, emotional response to situations. And, you know, and we don't probably need to wish that away, you know, more quickly than it naturally may want to go, you know. And but if it's, you know, if it, at some point you might say, this has been here long enough, I've it's been around long enough. And it sounds like that's exactly what happened. Felt like it's been around long enough, and now I can think about it differently.
Well, it was more, I think the preoccupation is more like obsessive thinking, but to feel grief, you know, is a more of an embodied, whole bodied, you know, experience of the loss. And then things lift after that. But yeah, I think you're right. It's a natural process that should be honored, but also allow a process to happen, not just to hold on to it.
Larry?
Thank you for that talk, Jim. When you distill it down to those three rules, as you so simply stated, you know, I find it inspiring to continue my practice with those three principles in mind. You know, you used You talked about two things that were, you know, foremost in your talk, which is what some of the people have just asked about, preoccupation. And then you also talked about dispelling things from mind. And maybe there's a relationship, because I looked up, you know, I did look at my iPhone while you were talking, but it was only to look up the definition of dispel. I was just curious about that. And the Merriam-Webster says to dispel is to drive away or cause to vanish by or as if by scattering, to cause to vanish. And when you have a preoccupation with it, it's like, There's a relationship to me as I listen between dispelling and maybe a preoccupation. I think just my thought. I mean, Dave had a great question. When does involvement turn into preoccupation? And maybe it's when you no longer can accept things as they are and you want it to be different than what it is, and thereby become attached to it. I think Dora Lee was talking about wanting something to be other than what it was. So, and to dispel, when we sit and bring mind to foremost and dispel everything other than mind, it's an interesting question. How do you make something disappear, you know? And there's no easy answers to that. We all find the answers to that on the cushion as we sit, but maybe it also has something to do with allowing something to be as it is. And the same answer maybe for preoccupation. And you know, Todd, I think Todd is here t- tonight, and he referred to a term in our study group, and I've been thinking about it for a week now, and I just loved what he said, to allow. When you sit and you have something that you want to dispel, maybe you just sit and you allow and let it vanish by itself. And so that's just the thoughts I have today.
Thank you, Larry. One of our, you know, the teaching of dispelling preoccupation came from a sangha, and he is, like I said, one of the founders of the Yogacara school. And the most radical teaching in all of Buddhism comes from the Yogacara school. And that teaching is that there actually is nothing before the mind. There is nothing before the mind. That nothing exists outside of mind. So this is a very radical teaching, but it's worth taking in and examining in our practice, that there is nothing before the mind. So anything that appears before the mind is, you know, from this point of view, it's a spell. What appears before the mind is a spell. And when you recognize that what's appearing is a spell, then the natural state of mind is dispelling, is letting go of the spell and returning to, there's really nothing before the mind. This is the radical teaching of the Yogacara school, which is difficult to take in, but nevertheless, quite liberative in a certain way.
Love that.
Well, I don't see any more hands, and it's 8:34. So, we have this brave plan, you know, to meet in person, and I believe Larry will be, maybe we have to talk, Larry, about how our Zoom is going to appear from the Dharma Center, which we have a system to make it appear from there. So if you're not comfortable, or, you know, certainly, have conditions in your household that make it difficult to come to the Dharma Center, then we should be available to you for most events. We'll see how it works. But we have been available on Thursday mornings to people who want to sit with us, and that's been working. Also, the study group's been working on Zoom from the Dharma Center. So we have this wonderful system that Larry and Brett Gardali, another member of our Sangha, have been diligently working on for months to make this broadcast possible. You'll be impressed if you haven't seen the Dharma Transmission Cart, as I've called it, with all of its cameras and computers and monitor and so forth. So we'll see you next Monday from the Dharma Center. And if you're there, how wonderful. And if not, we'll send out a Zoom link, and it'll be the same Zoom link that we've been using. So we will see you on Zoom, and it'll be another experiment in hybrid Zendo.